Welcome to Building Leaders, everyone, the show about the creative geniuses that are building our world. My name is Angelos Nicolaou. I'm the director at Sector and your host. Joining us from Sector today is also Michalis Solomontos, our vice president. Our guest today is Dimitris Kitchos, vice president of risk management and operations planning at DeMac Properties. If you're thinking that Dimitris is an organizational genius, then you're probably correct. Like many expat engineers, Dimitris started his career in a construction company. But from that point on, his career was anything but usual. Dimitris talks us through all the peaks and valleys of his path in construction, and even how, of all things, he ended up starting and running a successful grocery store on the side. Now, everyone, we do apologize for the bad sound quality of this episode. Social distancing rules did not leave us much choice. But what we can promise you is that the insights of Dimitris more than make up for it. We hope you enjoy listening. So if you can start by introducing yourself and what you do and where you're working right now.
So my name is Dimitris Kitchios. I'm originally from Greece and I've spent most of my life abroad. To be honest, I've only spent a few years in Greece and I have never really worked in Greece. So I consider myself very international. I have spent time professionally in a few countries, from East to West, Middle East. You know, from that sense, from that perspective, I feel very privileged to have the opportunity, you know, to do that, and especially at a very young age. My background is engineering. I studied civil engineering in Greece. I graduated 20 years ago, and then I started a career abroad with my first full-time job being in Singapore. I have to tell you, it was a dream for me to work in Southeastern Asia, especially in my very first steps in my career. Then I moved to Qatar.
So you're from Greece and then you studied in Thessaloniki. Are you from there?
Yes, I am from Thessaloniki. Actually, I'm from a city very near Thessaloniki. It's called Katerini, which is probably 50, 60 kilometers from Thessaloniki. That's my that's where I'm originally from. But I did spend my university years in Thessaloniki, where I studied civil engineering. I have to tell you that while I was studying, I was taking internships. So I took a couple of very interesting internships just to have this push in my career, you know, the fast kickoff to my career. So I did spend a couple of months in Cyprus back in 98 while I was on my third year. I went to Dubai in 1999 and I spent the summer in Dubai. An internship with a construction company I later on started my full-time career with. And it was, as I said, I felt that it was very important for me. And that's always my advice to the young engineers, to have a big push as early as possible in your career. Try to get some experience. Try to learn as much as possible and as soon as possible.
And civil engineering, was that, you know, a dream of yours? Or was it the typical, what happens quite often, not typically, but what happens quite often in Greece where you apply for a few university degrees and whatever you get accepted in, you go there?
Yes, it was a dream. Yes, it was something I had an inclination towards. And I was fascinated from a very young age from the engineering mindset. I feel engineering careers are very flexible. They allow you to develop many interesting transferable skills. So from a career perspective, I thought it was the right career. I think I was a very practical guy. I like to give solutions to certain problems. I like to see change. And I think engineering enabled me to basically materialize these goals and these dreams I had. So it was a very conscious decision. It didn't just happen. I made it happen to a certain extent.
And then you worked for a few years and then you went to Stanford, right?
Correct. I finished my bachelor's degree in Greece as a civil engineer. We had a mandatory military service in Greece, which was 1.5 year when I was in the military service back in 2000. So after completing my military service, I started working for a construction company. I thought it was very important to get some professional experience before moving on to my postgraduate studies. That way you make a more informed decision as to what you want to dig deep into your life, you know, later on. So I prefer to probably work for 2-3 years, see if that's what I want to do and if that's really what satisfies me, and then, you know, decide to pursue some postgraduate studies. And this is what I did. I was fortunate enough to go with a very large international contractor, Archeodon, in Singapore, where I spent a little bit over a year. Very fascinating project, one of its kind. And obviously, as a young engineer, you go to Southeastern Asia, which is by itself a very exotic destination. And obviously, you land in a very international environment, a very demanding professional environment. And I think that had tremendous, it made tremendous difference in my career when you really start with A-League players around you. So I did spend a year in Singapore. Then the company decided that it was better for me to move to Qatar. And I did spend another 2 years in Qatar. At that time, I was dealing with a lot, I was involved in a lot of industrial and marine, heavy industrial and marine projects, very demanding projects. Qatar Petroleum was one of our clients. So I had to deal with very specific specifications early on. And at that time, I realized that probably now is the right time to start looking on my postgraduate studies. And while I was in Qatar, that these 2 years, I applied for my postgraduate studies in a few universities in the U.S. I was always excited by the idea of basically continuing my education in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to be admitted at Stanford, and that's what I did next.
I'm sure there's some bit of luck there, but there's also quite a bit of you being good at what you do, you having, you know, the grades, you passing the testing scores as you should to be admitted in a university like that. But it takes a lot of guts, right? It takes a lot of guts to have started a career, have gotten a job with some of the best construction companies in the world. And you are obviously in a pretty good trajectory. You went to Singapore, then you went to Qatar. These are dream jobs for people you were working with on mega projects with big clients. And then you went to the US. So you paused this and went to the US. Were you scared at all at the time that you're missing out, that your colleagues are continuing their careers and they might get those promotions and those better jobs by the time you come back?
No, not at all. I was actually very excited. I have been a big proponent and a big fan of building, you know, a wider skill set to create a broader world with multiple dimensions in my career. As a matter of fact, I would have been scared and really terrified by the idea of not doing it, you know, not trying to do that, not risking, taking some risks. And that would be my advice for everyone. Don't be afraid to risk. Don't be afraid to try different things. And if you fail, you just learn and you move on. Try to fail quickly, try to fail cheaply, and move on. And that was my mindset. I said, I will pause my career, I will go, I'll do my postgraduate studies, although I, as you said, I was in an upward trajectory, but I never regretted. I think we have to continuously learn new things, and more than ever today, and you have to pursue the dreams. Don't need the license to pursue your dreams, you just do it, just do it. And as I said, I had a plan, I had a structure, and I had a vision, and I think I was very loyal to that. Going back to a comment you said, I was never a top in my class. I was a good student from early on. What was important and what seems to really benefit me is that I always had a vision and I had a plan and I had a structure and I knew what my next steps would be in order to achieve that. I think that was the approach I had early on, which proved very, very beneficial.
Well, many people have plans, right? But what we see is many times those plans don't get followed through. What is your tip for following through a plan?
You have to keep trying, failing, and learn. You need to take risks. You need to get, as they say, out of your comfort zone. And that's how you build a plan, by learning from your failures. There's no perfect plan, and there's no perfect execution of the plan. You have to make it as you go, I guess. So I never had a perfect plan, and the plan never really worked exactly as I planned it. But more or less, I was on the right direction. And I think that's the important, to be on the right trend, regardless if you have ups and downs in the process.
You said it was a dream of yours to go to the U.S. I'm seeing a smile on your face as you're talking about it. I'm assuming you weren't disappointed going there.
Of course not. Of course not. First of all, as I said, Stanford has given me a lot of skills, a lot of connections. It exposed me to a lot of different, if you will, things in life that I never thought it was possible or I never thought it existed. Again, going back to my previous comment, it provided me with a broader aspect and view of the world and probably my capabilities and my choices, my options in life. And that was instrumental, I think, for my next steps. I would always encourage engineers in whatever country this is to, you know, embrace the new age. Don't get stuck in your place, in your region, in your country, or even an interconnected world. Take the risk, move abroad, live abroad, work abroad, even briefly.
Yeah.
Try to meet, try to mingle, try to socialize with people in different countries and in different industries. I think it's very difficult. It's very important to change and adapt. You know, you probably are aware of this concept that we have in Greece that, you know, once you study engineer, you basically die in engineering. You know, engineering right. Probably in Greece has a very narrow meaning. I never liked that. I never liked that. I think we have to understand that we need to change and adapt. And I think it's important that engineers need to always morph to something else. Today, for instance, construction industry suffers from lack of probably adopting or difficulty in adopting technology. And I think engineers should morph into technologists because technology is everywhere. It's not very prevalent in the construction industry yet, but I can see steps. And you are one excellent example. And I have to basically stress that I'm a big fan of what you do. I really enjoy and I think it's amazing what you do. The fact that you are trying to connect technology with construction. And you are an example of, you know, engineers by background, but who turned and morphed into technologists. And I think this is the important skill set and mindset and approach that engineers nowadays should have. And if I want to generalize, not only engineers, but probably all the professionals.
I love to see this rub off coming from, and I'm pretty sure that the US had this effect on you because the US education system is really good at giving you broader education as well. I remember a professor of mine it must have been my first week at Penn State starting to study my civil engineering degree. And he said, we're not going to teach you how to be civil engineers, but we will teach you how to think. That's all he said. And what he meant by that is, you know, your degree doesn't matter as much. You know, the title doesn't matter as much. The university doesn't matter as much. It's what you do with it that matters. And speaking of new age, first of all, thank you so much about the compliment. We really appreciate it. We are super passionate for what we do. So it's always great to hear positive
you
feedback. There's a long way. There's a long way to go. A long way to go. But, you know, we really believe in our mission. But speaking of new age and how young people think and young engineers think, as a Stanford graduate yourself, do you think that university degrees are as important today as they were in the past? Do you see a payoff, let's say, in your Ivy League education?
Look, Angela, that has been a debate in the last few years, and especially with the fact that education and online training and online education has become easier. So a lot of people are wondering whether it's really worth spending all this money because it's not cheap. It's
right.
Very expensive, actually, to pursue degrees in prestigious universities. The short answer is yes. I do believe it's an investment that bears probably the highest yield. And in my case, I would have done it again. Definitely knowledge is all around us. It's more accessible than it was, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago, when a degree meant a specific set of knowledge, specific you know, volume of knowledge transferred from the university to the individual. That can be done in multiple ways nowadays. But still, the university is more than the pure transfer of knowledge. It's the interaction. It's the networking. It is probably lifelong friendships or potential partnerships. So this is something that you can't really get anywhere else except from the university, except in places where you have a gathering, an aggregation of people, of like-minded people working or studying together. So this unique environment and climate can only be fostered in universities. So yes, I do believe there is value and there is some kind of an investment that, that really pays off in the long term.
Well, we are social creatures.
Absolutely.
We kind of see that effect in cities as well. You know, cities is where a lot of discoveries are made often because of a big part of that being friction with other people. So it's really interesting to hear that coming from me. I'm a big fan of universities, and something I ask myself is, would I want my kid to go to university? And the answer is yes. And I want it to be a physical university. And part of that is what you just described right now, that it's good to be surrounded with other people. It's good to get out of your comfort zone. Do that. But after college, after Stanford, did you stay in the US? Because that seems to be a career, especially with these Ivy League schools. It seems to be, you know, you kind of get sucked in because the US really knows how to propel you into excellence, into leadership, especially if you're good. Did you get sucked in as well, or did you move back?
Briefly, I managed to escape. And I'm not saying this with a negative connotation. Obviously, I really enjoyed my almost 3 years in the U.S. I did work after the university. I had the options. I decided to work for a major engineering consulting firm, Fluor Corporation. I remained in California. I moved a little bit south to Orange County. And I spent almost a year there with Fluor. But it was a time when I always maintained very good relationships with my previous employer. Dubai was booming back in 2006, 2007. So things just happened that way. And I found myself back to Dubai, where I spent the next 5 years traveling in the region a lot, you know, dealing and being involved with projects in Oman and Qatar, in Bahrain. I have been, I would say, in my recent professional years, I've been quite involved in project management and commercial management. And that gave me a very good visibility across the board, across the whole, you know, departments and divisions of the project or an organization. So I did leave the U.S. I was, I guess, one of the exceptions, as you said, because it tends to suck you in.
Yeah.
But I feel privileged to that I had moved back to Dubai at the time when Dubai was the new El Dorado, you know, and it really provided huge opportunities.
Huge opportunities in what sense?
It was, and it still remains, a place where there is rapid growth, there's no limits, there are few restrictions. If somebody is good and ambitious, I think he can probably, Dubai is the right place for him to explore his capabilities. So that's what I mean. It obviously was a place undergoing tremendous growth back in 2007, right, even earlier.
Yeah.
But it was also an ecosystem of people that were not afraid to try new things, were not afraid to push the limits. People, governments, corporations. I mean, don't forget that the government of Dubai and Abu Dhabi and you know, many other countries in the GCC are constantly pushing the limits, and they will always look for new ways and different ways and more efficient ways to do things. So you want to be part of this. You want to be part. You want to live in a region where really embraces change.
Yeah. And coming back to Dubai, you went back to Arhirodon and, you know, typical contractor, but then you founded your own business.
Yes, I did that. And I did that a couple of times in my life. I did have this, I would say, entrepreneurship or desire to try things. Again, it goes back to the motto of try different things. Don't be afraid to fail. Keep what works and move on. And maybe bury evidence if you did something wrong. Okay. So, yes, I did a very upscale grocery store, a supermarket, with a partner. We did that in Jumeirah, in a generally upscale area of Dubai. And I was involved from the setup, of the place, you know, pretty much doing everything. It was, you know, from operations to business development to basically managing suppliers, contracts, yeah, pretty much everything that I was doing in my previous professional years.
What does upscale supermarket mean? What did you just tell?
So an upscale supermarket, what I consider an upscale supermarket, is a supermarket that provides you with options that you can't find easily anywhere else. Okay. So we have a lot of gluten-free products, a lot of
Wagyu beef,
say, options or products from different places in the world. That was back in 2014. So 6 years ago, a lot of our options of like organic or gluten-free products were not really as popular as they are today. I would say they were just kicking off. So we had a lot of healthy and rare products in our shelves. And it was a very beautiful place. It was a very beautiful venue. We really, myself and the partner, really put a lot of effort in making it as beautiful and friendly to the customer as we could. Obviously, it was a new industry for me, so I had to learn everything from scratch. And again, there was a learning curve, obviously, and we did a lot of mistakes. I regret nothing about it, and we had this business for almost 3 years, after which we exited through a transition, through a sale of the business to another group of companies.
Yes, wow, that's great. Did you do this on the side, or did you quit and go for it?
Correct. That was a side venture.
Wow. You were at Parsons at the time, right? After you went to Parsons, which is a pretty demanding job on its own. But were you working at night, late at night, to do the business ops?
Pretty much. So I did work for Parsons at the time in a very demanding, iconic program, $11 billion capital development program. And I had a very demanding job, actually, in a senior role. But I was finishing work at 7:30, going straight to my store, and then spending every Friday and Saturday, basically every weekend there. It was an exhausting period of my time. And probably that's where I learned that you can't do everything right. So maybe you have to select, maybe you have to prioritize. So yes, you can do everything in life, but not at the same time.
Were you married at the time? Did you have kids?
Yes. So having a family life, having a job, and then having a business on the side. That's where I learned that you have to really prioritize things in life. As I said, you can do everything, but you have to be careful not to do everything at the same time.
Sounds tough.
Dimitri?
Yes?
Out of all the side hustle businesses you could have built, why a supermarket store?
To be honest, it just happened. I had a partner who was successful in that. He was in that industry, the FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods industry. And I think I was a partner who was like, it seemed a very good idea that I like the fact that, in fact, we can have a good cash flow if you are performing well. So I like the concept of that at that time. I liked it.
I like the concept just hearing about it, to be honest with you.
You have to deal with a lot of parameters. I remember we had, if I'm not mistaken, like 9,000 barcodes. That is 9,000 unique products. So obviously, all this creates a logistical nightmare, managing so many barcodes, so many different products, which obviously most of them have an expiry date. So you go into trying to improve or minimize your waste, improve your productivity, you deal with employees, you have government regulations to abide by. So again, very similar to construction and engineering, where you have all these restrictions and you need to operate within a very restricted environment and still perform, execute, and build something unique.
Do you consider yourself an organizational genius? Where do you find the brain power to manage your engineering job, your family, and a supermarket with 9,000 SKUs?
First of all, I don't consider myself anything close to a genius. I have made a lot of mistakes, as I said before, and I just have a positive attitude towards learning from mistakes. I'm a good planner. I think I tend to plan things in a probably more efficient way than others. And I think having this structure and plan and consistent vision, consistently pursuing this plan, is the key.
Do you have a daily planner that you write all your tasks down, or do you use software for that? What do you do? I'm really interested.
I do actually. It's the typical old-fashioned way. I do write my tasks for the day, and I cross out the ones that are actualized, the ones that are out of my way.
I'd love to see that planner, and I hope you have the history of that planner as well.
But I would argue, Rigetta, that planning is always good, and it's paramount importance. I wish I was a little bit more creative, a little bit more, free spirit.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably one of the things that we don't learn in engineering schools, creativity part. And I'm the first one to admit that, I have not learned and I have not really worked on that skill, And I believe it's very important to draw inspiration and creativity from everywhere around you, because ideas can come from everywhere. And I think that having too much plan and too much structure is probably, I would argue, detrimental to your creativity.
Right.
Although I did read somewhere recently that creativity loves constraint. Basically, the more constraint you have, the more creative you have to be, right? But I think if you have too many constraints, you may be skipping your creativity. So I wish I was more creative. I wish engineers were more creative. I wish, we had this fusion of practical and pragmatic sense of things, as well as the dreamy, creative layer of the other professions have.
Well, that's the paradox. I didn't read that about creativity, although it does make a lot of sense. But you need creativity to build anything, to come up with something. But then you need structure in order to execute that. And the structure helps you go back and feed creativity. There's a great book, The Innovator's Dilemma. I don't know if you've read it. But it talks about how big companies continue to innovate. And one of the trends that the late Clay Christensen saw by studying these companies was that even in very large organizations, the ones that were able to continue to innovate were the ones that had a constrained culture within, whether that was spinning off another company, Amazon does this to this day, or it was to have low budget teams that were constrained and had to go through that hustle in order to innovate. It's really interesting how the brain works in that way.
Yes, you are right. You're right. And that's why I think it's important in every business and every project in life to have somebody that supplements you, because we have our strengths, we have our weaknesses. I think it's important to pick and choose the people that really supplement you in life, in personal life or in business life. Generally, we can only do so much alone, but by having the right partnerships, and when I say partnerships again, beyond the business sense, I think that's what really makes the difference.
Yeah. And at Parsons at the time, Parsons is obviously a large organization, much larger than, Arhirodon is, not to undermine Arhirodon, but, Parsons is huge and it's on the consulting side now. How was that experience for you?
So that role was a very unique role because we were doing the program management for and on behalf of Abu Dhabi Airports Company. So we had a very integrated organization with Abu Dhabi Airports Company, a government, semi-government organization that embarked in an $11 billion airport capital development program. You can understand the magnitude and the complexity of that. Airports are very complex programs and projects. Airports are not buildings. Airports are buildings with intelligence systems within their structure. So, and again, projects that involved a huge number of stakeholders. So I did that for 6 years. I was very happy to be promoted. And my final year with Parsons, I was the program director for such a prestigious, unique, iconic program. And it was probably, I would say, one of the unique opportunities, few opportunities. I had to meet a lot of people that I learned from, and also be in an organization, both Parsons and Abu Dhabi Airports, that really had a lot to to teach me. I'm really proud, actually, for being part of this program for 6 years.
Yeah, sounds incredible. And then was that what opened the gates for you to go to the Mac? And the interesting thing about your career is that you've really gone through all the ranks of the construction industry. You were with a contractor, then you went with a consultant, then you went with the owner. Was that on purpose or it was just going with the flow?
It was a little bit of both. I didn't consciously chose that, but yes, that was my strategy and it went along these lines. So after spending 6 years with Parsons and being the head of an $11 billion program, I had the opportunity to join DAMAC. That was approximately 2 years ago. And I joined DAMAC in a very unique role. I was the vice president for risk management and planning for the organization. I was basically dealing and working with a lot of very smart and very ambitious and very accomplished individuals. Obviously, I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with the chairman and founder of DAMAC Properties, Mr. Hossein Sajouani, who has been a great mentor for me. I am in a transitionary period now, so very soon I'm hoping to finalize my next role. But the past 2 years, almost 2 years with DAMAC, have taught me so many things. And I had a wider role there. I had a risk management, planning, even business performance. So I was lucky enough to have a visibility across the board of the company, looking at KPIs from different departments, CRM, marketing, talent acquisition, sales. So that gave me a very broad perspective as to how a developer works or should be operating. And it was a fantastic school. It was a fantastic school. Again, I'm trying to make the most out of every tenure and every interaction I have and every professional or personal interaction I have. And it's very important, I think, to learn from everywhere. Anyone.
I'm seeing a bit of a rabbit hole here because you want to be more creative in your life, in your career. You know you're great at operations and you go into a role of risk management, which is the antithesis of creativity.
Yes, yes.
Am I right? Right or wrong?
No, it's a valid point. It's a valid point, but risk management in a family business is, I think, has a lot of more practical aspects. So it's not risk management in the sense of like governance and compliance and risk. It's more a pragmatic approach, more of a hands-on approach. So you need to basically escalate the risk to the ownership of the company and the management of the company, and you need to do that very clearly, very concisely, so that the proper actions and measures are taken. And we did that, obviously myself and the very good team I had, in a way that was very, as I said, hands-on. Obviously, the owner of the company is very much involved in the company. He knows in and out what's happening in the business. So you have to raise the bar high. So risk management was not, again, like a theoretical, I would say, function.
Yeah.
It was, you had to be following very closely the operations, as well as the other departments, in order to identify, report, and mitigate the risks. So yes, your point is valid. It was something new to me, but it was the way we executed, the way we performed it, and the map was not isolated. Everything was integrated in a way in order to achieve the best results.
Is there a way to be a great risk manager without being a pessimist or the negative person in the room? And I'm saying this, I want to explain myself because I don't want to sound that I'm being pessimistic myself. I'm a very optimistic person. I like to be open and free and as creative as I can be. It just sounds restricting to me. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that feel this way. And it's a question I'm really interested in knowing from you because I'm seeing you, you're a very positive, high energy individual.
Yes, generally risk management has a negative connotation, right? The opposite of risk is opportunity, right? So there is also opportunity management. And to be honest, as a risk manager, you have to be also an opportunity manager in the sense that you have to look or the positive risk, the opportunities in every situation. So it's not all negative. It's not about reporting or handling all the negative, the pessimistic aspects. If you have a good handle, a good understanding of the risks, maybe you become more optimistic sometimes because you realize that maybe there are not so much risk. Maybe there are more opportunities. So, you know, there's a fallacy here that, you know, risk management is pessimistic, it's all negative. No, if you really do proper risk management, you may be even more optimistic than you would have been otherwise, because you know where your risks lie, you know what you have in place to mitigate them, and therefore you can exploit and leverage the opportunities that come up.
Makes sense. And I see the optimistic side of you coming out, and I'm sure that's why you were great at that role. But you spoke about a transition in your phase, and you know, you've done plenty of things in your life, right? You went to work, then you went to college, then you got a job in the US, then you went back to the UAE, then you changed career paths a few times. So you've been through these transitionary phases before. What events trigger such a decision?
First of all, I think many things in life are random. Like we want to believe that we are in control, but most of the times life is a random walk. So many of the things that triggered my career moves were random. Although I'd like to believe that I had a role in this. But I think it's important to know your personality, you know your strengths, where you're good at, where you need improvement, and what you want to achieve. So it's basically being in control of this Venn diagram, where you know where the market is and where you can be successful, right, professionally, and you know where your strengths are. And I think it's a balance. It's a continuous battle to try to integrate and optimize this. So a lot of events, to be honest, I can't think of specific events that figured that. It was, I would say, probably random occasions, right, that maybe led me to certain paths. But to a certain degree, I knew that when this path came in front of me, that was the right path for me. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
It makes sense, especially when you start talking about Venn diagrams, and sort of reminds me of your Ikigai. What is your purpose in life, but also helps you contribute to those around you and also helps you make a living. So when one of these things goes out of balance and you're someone who's ambitious, not necessarily ambitious to, you know, make it become the wealthiest person on earth, but ambitious to be happy in life and to contribute to the world. And one of those things goes out of balance, it starts to strike you and it starts to urge you to make a decision. But the most interesting part about you and your story is that you started off by saying you're not afraid to take risks. And that's what we've seen on and on and on. You really are not afraid to take risks. It's incredible. It's actually very inspiring to see that.
Yes. I mean, I don't consider myself as the most risk-seeking person on earth. Obviously, I have many friends that are, you know, and then people I know that are much more risk-seeking than I am. I tend to be conservative oftentimes, but sometimes I would take the risk. So again, it goes back to really knowing yourself and knowing when to take risks. It's a decision, right? We take decisions every day in life. One of the best courses I had that were life-changing at Stanford was the decision analysis, where I was amazed to see how wrongly we take decisions. You know, most of us, not all of us. So there is a decision-taking and decision-making process. And I would really encourage and I would really promote that to everyone, and especially engineers. Try to study decision analysis, try to read about decision analysis, the framework, the mechanics, the structure behind how we make decisions and how we should be making decisions. And I think this will change your lives. Look at data objectively, unbiased. You know, data is apolitical, as they say. So it's important for us engineers to analyze data before we take any decisions. And then you can you have to know your risk profile. And if you have a good or a fairly good decision analysis and you know your risk profile, then I think most of the times the outcome will be positive. Obviously not always, but if you do it consistently, yes. Final outcome, I believe, will be positive.
You've been through the ranks. You have been educated by some of the best universities in the world, some of the best professors. You worked at some of the best companies in the world. And you're in an industry that is kind of stuck in the past, in a big sense of the word. How would you like to see construction 10 years from now?
Construction is an industry in dire need of transformation. If you see how other industries have evolved in the last 50 years, and you compare that with construction, okay, it will be very apparent immediately that construction is falling far behind. Look at how planes were manufactured, or phones, or TVs, or electronics were manufactured 50 years ago, and how they're being produced today. It's radically different. But look at construction. You go on a site 50 years ago, you go on a site today. Yes, some tools, some equipment have changed. Obviously, they have improved. But essentially, we are using the same methodologies, the same process. If you have taken a construction worker from the 1960s and you magically placed him in a site today, he would probably, you know, within a few days, he would probably be able to perform. But if you try to do that with a manufacturing worker in a different industry, he would be completely lost.
Yeah. What are all these robots? What are all these arms doing around me?
Exactly, which we don't have in construction. So there is a big problem, which means that there is also a big opportunity where you and sector is trying to tap. Construction has been a very old-fashioned, rigid industry. As I said, it's in dire need of transformation. It needs to change. But it seems that change is very slow. It's more like trying to turn a large cruise ship rather than trying to turn a skateboard. So I think it's imperative that we have less resistance to change. I think it's important for engineers to change their mindset, adopt technologies. It's all about innovation, not about perfection. You don't have to be perfect. As long as you innovate, you will have good results. Don't stick into being the perfect, the best. It's good enough, move on, innovate. So I think that's important for everybody to understand. It requires a new mindset. We need to invest as a construction. We need to invest in new technologies, the Internet of Things, the drones, digitization. We don't see that, or we see it in a very small scale. Obviously, there are some underlying reasons for that, but I think now is the more than ever the right period to do that, to see this new generation of construction, to condition our brains differently, you know, operate differently as engineers, as construction leaders. I think there's a huge opportunity lying in front of you.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. We really do hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you think that it delivered value to you, please share it with a friend who will appreciate it as well. Thanks.